Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuckinistas? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show. This is my podcast, WTF, with me, Mark Maron. Thank you for listening. Happy 4th of July. Keep it happy. Don't lose any digits. Don't get killed in some dumb way. Don't drive all fucked up. Keep alert for those others who are not heeding my advice or didn't necessarily hear it, and they might not know not to drive all fucked up. Try not to eat too much shit that you're going to feel horrible for too long a time. Don't set fire to anything. Don't blow up any small animals, all right? Don't go down the slippery moral slope to, like, do you think that thing will burn? Can you catch it? Don't do that. Those days are behind you, all right? If you've got really fun fireworks, just be careful with the kids. You're a grown-up, you know. Be a careless asshole if you want, but just not when kids are around. If you want to shoot Roman candles at each other because you're all shit-faced, you're just getting excited because there's things blowing up and light and fire and sounds, and it's so fun, and you just want to just keep blowing shit up, and it's awesome, do it. But, you know, just do it as a grown-up. Only be dangerous with grown-up friends. If there are children around, limit the danger for them. But, like, if you're just on your own and you don't have kids, knock yourself out. But, again, don't die in some stupid way. Years ago, I didn't realize that you could shoot Roman candles at each other. It's not on the label. It's not recommended. I don't even think they're fucking legal in this country, to be honest with you. But that doesn't stop anything from happening here. Right? Me and Nick Schwartzen at Zach Galifianakis's party about over a decade ago down in Venice just started fucking shooting Roman candles at each other, setting shit on fire, you know, in a controlled way. I'm getting excited just thinking about it. I haven't been to a party where there was massive amounts of fireworks. Oh, man. I'm a 52-year-old man, and I'm not really prone to guns or explosions. But, man, if you show up with a bag of shit that lights up and blows up and spins fire and sparks, I am fucking there with the lighter. Happy 4th of July. Think about your freedoms today, right? Meditate on that. Think about what they really are. Think about your life. Really ponder the lie you're living out of necessity so you don't walk through the streets terrified and sad. Oh, that's not, that got away from me. So look, today Jeff Goldblum is on the show. It was a real thrill to talk to him because I really, you know, he's one of those guys, no matter how many movies he's been in or whether you really know all his movies, you know him. He's just one of those people that's been familiar. He's been there for all of us somehow for years. You see him and you're like, there's Jeff Goldblum acting like Jeff Goldblum. And I wanted him to be Jeff Goldblum, like, immediately, and he delivered. He showed up in my house. He walked in. He's like, oh, okay, this is it, huh? This is, the house. Where's the garage? This is, you'll hear it. He Jeff Goldblums the shit out of this episode. So consistent, so beautiful. Great guy, great actor, and a creative person. I enjoyed seeing him and having him around. I wanted to be around him more. I would have been fine if he moved in, but he's got a baby. His baby turns 1 year old today on Independence Day, and his movie, Independence Day Resurgence, is now in theaters. It's out. But today's the day. And his kid is 1 year old today, the Goldblum kid. Happy birthday to him. And we'll talk to Jeff in a little while. My tour dates. I keep doing this because I think it's important that I do it because I'm not really, I'm not doing the Facebook thing really. I'm doing Twitter, but the Facebook thing, there's something suspect about the whole business. Spokane, this weekend, this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 7, 8, and 9. Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, 14, 15, and 16 of July. The Comedy Attic in Bloomington, the 28th, 29th, and 30th of July. And then we take a little leap to August, August 18th and 19th and 20th at Stand Up Live in Phoenix. I'll be in Albuquerque September 3rd for one night at the Albuquerque Journal Theater doing a benefit. I'll be at the Comedy Club in Rochester September 9th and 10th. And those are the dates that are up right now. There will be more. I'm doing club dates to get my shit straight. To get to work it out and to engage with the people. So I told you guys about that kitten. Well, the kitten is being fed and sort of loved over at Sarah's house, and we're gonna make the move over here, but we couldn't do it. I couldn't take the kitten right in because I got two indoor cats. I needed to prepare to integrate a kitten that it turns out is not feral but very lovable. And I'm going to now tell you the new kitten's name. I will be welcoming Buster into my home later today. That's a Buster, the black cat. All black cat. Buster. Buster, buddy. Buster. What's up, Buster? It's good. It's good. He looks like a Buster. Showed up on my stoop. Vulnerable little cat out of nowhere. There's no other kittens around. This fucker just finds my goddamn porch. All right? So it was meant to be. But I only got two rooms in my house. The second bedroom, there's a closet in there, all my records in there, and that means, like, all of that could be destroyed. Kittens will destroy everything. It's profound. You don't know how it happens. You've got this little cat, little tiny cat, not much bigger than your hand. You close that door, and you're like, okay, see you tomorrow, Buster. See you tomorrow. Maybe you hear some sounds, and you're like, well, what's that? What's going on? The next morning, you wake up. 1,000 records are destroyed. All of your shoes are fucked up. The light fixture is dangling. There are things that you didn't know you had still that now you have to throw away. Kittens will fuck shit up. I know that from experience. So I had to go down to Best Hardware, got to buy some plywood, got to get it cut. So I made some makeshift protectors of my record shelves. I had to get Dennis and I collaborated on the design of a door, not stop, but blocker. The bottom of my old door has a little too much space where the cat could get through. So we created out of a 2x4 and a leftover piece of plywood, a little thing that you can block that hole with. I measured it. He cut the wood. He fucking screwed it together and even threw a coat of spray paint on there. So got that all set. Now I got to get the doorknob fixed because it's missing a thing. And then we're good to go. Everything should be kitten proofed and Buster can move in. So here we go. Jeff Goldblum, Lake Bell had put me in touch with him. I tried to get him on the show for a while. We were sort of randomly texting each other here and there, and it finally happened. And I was very excited to talk to him. I think I forgot to talk to him about music, though, but that's all right. I saw him playing. He's a very good piano player, but we had a beautiful conversation. So why don't we just do that? Why don't we just listen to me and Jeff Goldblum? And again, be
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Careful. You look great.
Do you think so?
Thank you. So do you. It's one of these, you're one of those guys where I'm like, wow, he still looks great. How is, you know, that's great that he looks so good.
Thank you, my friend.
Is that, did I say that wrong? Was that bad?
No. It was, that's only flattering. No. And that still part, I know what you're talking about. No, that's just stating the facts, you know. I've just been, I could look a lot worse, yeah, given the chronology. That's correct. But you look at you. You look like a 70s movie star. You look like, you know, young Elliot Gould from, you know.
Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Did you ever work with Elliot Gould?
You know. No, and yes. I mean, I appeared, our paths crossed, but we weren't in the same scenes together.
Oh, an Altman movie?
In a couple of Altman movies. My first Altman movie, which was my... Jesus, second movie ever after Death Wish was California Split.
Right.
Did you ever see that? Yeah, that's kind of what you look. He had kind of a. Did he have a mustache?
A longer thing. I think he had a longer thing. And he did. What did you do in that? What did you have?
Oh, you know, I had two scenes where I'm George Siegel's boss, a kind of a wunderkind editor of this magazine.
Yeah.
Called California Scene, S-E-E-N.
Right.
And he's, you know, screwing off and gambling, da-da-da. And I have a scene where I'm kind of...
You were like king of the little scenes for a while there.
Yeah, I was never king of anything, but I was in a couple little scenes here. So we were in that movie together, and then he appeared as himself in Nashville.
Right.
And I had a little scene or two in that.
You were the guy in the bike. Yeah. Right
on the tricycle, the big tricycle man
with the big goggles on,
exactly, doing sleight of hand here and there.
Did you know how to do that?
I did not. And Robert Altman, in this script, you know, it had no magic for this character, but he called me up and said, I was living in New York then, West Village. He said, you know, hey, do you know any sleight of hand?
Uh-huh.
I said, no. He said, well, get together with a coach. We'll find you a coach or in New York and learn some. Bring a bag full of them down to Nashville when you come down, and maybe we'll put them in some scenes. And I did. When I got there, I showed him my tricks.
Yeah.
I worked with this guy, Cohen Norton. And he said, okay, good. I'm not sure where we'll put him, but bring him to the set every time you work, and we'll figure it out. And I put him in a bunch of scenes, and a couple of them made it in. And then I discarded all of them, but I kept practicing, and I can still do my rope tricks.
Yeah.
A series of, you know, here's the knot, there's
that
not
undoes
the knot,
itself.
And that done does itself. Yeah.
Well,
which I've snuck in a couple of other movies.
Oh, really?
Yes, I have.
Isn't it interesting because, like, somehow or another, he, like, in the context of that huge movie, yeah, hours long,
yeah,
dozens of characters,
yeah,
your character, in my memory, reappears quite a bit.
I do. Yep.
That, you know, you're just sort of this presence that sort of moves through, you know, different points in the movie.
Yeah.
But, like, he was sitting up at night, and he had, you were very specific. You were on this giant tricycle. You were, you know, this a clown almost in a way.
Interesting. Okay.
With the big goggles. No, not in a bad way. That there was a comedic presence to it.
Yeah.
And he just wakes up one night and goes, that guy needs to be doing tricks. You know, like it was a decision.
Well, you're right. His interesting creative, I mean, I love the creative, you know, inspiration anyway. And he was an exemplar of a guy who was mysteriously talented and imaginative and unique and self-trustful and went with his own ideas.
Well, what was it like being on one of those sets? Because you did a couple of his movies. Like, was it was everybody? Did you know where the movie stopped and where real life sort of began, or was everybody hanging out with each other and
hanging out? Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what he like. You know, recently Wes Anderson, who I think is a fan of his. They like to, and Robert Altman liked to make the shooting an art piece in itself.
Uh-huh.
And he called his production company Sand Castle Films or something like that, because he had the metaphor of what we're doing is really like we're making sandcastles.
Right.
And you do the moat this time, and you do the bridge this time, and you do the tower this time, and just for the fun of it. And of course, the water will come in and take it all away, but we had a reason to get together,
uh-huh,
just to be together.
So it's sort of
and make something together just for the fun of it.
That was a looseness then, in
yes,
a way.
There sure was a looseness, but there was an intent blended, communality.
Yeah, yeah.
And spirit. And we would, he would, for instance, show the dailies every night and invite everybody.
Really?
And it was a great, great, yeah. Because he said, you know, that's the movie. Once we pretty it up and cut it up, that's something else. But this is our work. We all did it equally. All look at our work.
Really?
Yes. It was delightful.
It was like almost a party.
It was a real party. He was a kind of party guy.
Yeah.
But very creative. And in Nashville, we all lived in the same complex. So it was a real summer, hoop-de-doo.
And Wes does vacation. That too, because Wes, like stylistically, I would say is almost the polar opposite.
Very meticulous.
Yeah, it's like every frame is like a jewelry box.
That's right. It's been said. That's right. You ever read that?
Someone said that, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael Chabon.
Oh, is he the one who said it? The jewelry box?
Well, he makes a very, yes, he equates him with, who's that guy now who does those boxes?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. An artist?
Art boxes. Yeah. Yeah, I'm forgetting now.
But how controlled is that set?
Well, it's controlled. So we were taught, so what got us into this was that they both have the same spirit, but some of their other elements are very different. Yes, Altman was like, you know, a painter that just kind of made it up as he went along, and the painting process produced the painting, and what does it feel like? What do I feel like doing now? And, and then just kind of organic, very organically kind of reveals itself. Wes has drawings, and he's written everything, and he's drawn out and described the costumes, and he knows exactly what it is. It's all that. I could tell you, for instance, on Grand Budapest Hotel, I had a couple of big speeches. I'm nothing if not conscientious, and I'd practiced them. And in one, I knew he was meticulous. I'd done that, you know, Life Aquatic.
Yeah.
I thought I like a little the phrasing of this one sentence. I'm going to change this. I think it was an and to a but or something like that.
Yeah.
And I practiced it, and I did, and I thought, oh, here's the way. And then I got to the set. And we did. I didn't tell him.
Yeah.
We did it again. He said, yeah, very good. Okay, let's do it again. Say, Jeff, did you, I think you changed one thing. Yes, I did. Can I tell you why? Because I've got, it's not just higgledy-piggledy. Right. Here's my reason. Because I thought, he said, very interesting. Okay, I think do it my way. Do it my way, if you will. Okay, I got you. I will. Like that. So he's very, very meticulous. But within that, he's somehow Altman-esque in his freedom, somehow an enjoyment of you, and somehow collaborative encouragement.
But what's the experience as an actor when, you know, you are working, when you're walking into a scene that is so meticulously organized, you know, you... Because you bring a certain amount, you're uniquely yourself. There's, you know what I mean. When you see you, or even if you hear your voice, you're like, it's just Jeff Goldblum.
Hey,
you're one of those guys.
Well, I like to be able to. I like to think that I'm able to characterize,
of course,
you know, and drop some of these.
But your intensity,
stupid affectations,
the life frequency that is Goldblum-esque.
Well, okay,
stay steady.
I accept it.
And so when you're working with, what is the thrill then? Like, there must be some excitement, you know, like working with someone like Altman, where they're just sort of like, all right, hang out, man. Let's just hang out, which was a part of the time.
Yeah.
You know, that was culture at that time.
Yeah.
But I imagine the excitement of working with someone like Wes is like, this is so organized that it's going to be spectacular. Like, it's not all hinging on me. It's part of it's hinging on that light. Like, you know, like you're like in the, like.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You feel very well taken care of, and you trust. But of course, Altman in another way, so that you can kind of do anything, and he'll cut it up into something nice,
right?
But Wes in another way, you go, wow, everything is. I'm given every help that I can be given. What with my glasses and my very thought about hair and goatee and da da da, and the light and the great cinematographer Bob Yeoman, you know.
Yeah, and where'd you guys shoot that?
We shot that kind of not unlike the experience in Nashville in 1973. We shot it in Görlitz, Germany. He likes to go on these exotic adventures on Life Aquatic. We were in Rome. We shot at Cinecittà, and then in Gore Vidal's villa in the south of Italy.
How did that happen?
Oh, he knows many sophisticates, you know, in many different layers of... No, I'd met him on another occasion because he's a relative of Burr Steers.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're all related to Aaron Burr.
Right. Goes back.
I just saw that Hamilton musical.
I did, too. Do you like it?
Yes, I did. Did you?
Yes, very exciting.
Very exciting.
Did you talk to
I went backstage. He couldn't have been nicer to me.
Sweet guy.
Very, very sweet and wildly talented. Yeah.
Did you, are you a hip-hop person in general? No, not really. But no, we're a little older and it's not a matter of age, but you do have to listen. Do you know, that was the interesting thing about Hamilton. If you don't grow up with hip-hop or rap, where it's second nature to just take in the narrative, like I really was like, all right, I gotta lock in.
Listen, I know what you mean. I like to, even in a movie, in any kind of movie, no matter how slowly they're talking, I like to see the words. Yeah. I like to read along with it.
Do you?
Yes, I do. It's not that I'm going deep or anything like that, but I like to, well, I'm an actor, so I like to say, hey, well, when I like to see it on the page.
Yeah.
So I like to see it. I like to read it, goddamn.
Even if it's in
and
English.
And at Hamilton, you really needed to.
You gotta lock in.
Yeah, you gotta lock in. I could see it again now, and I could study the CD, so I could really know exactly what they're talking about, not miss a word.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Shakespeare. And then, and of course, learn a little bit more about history,
right,
too, to which they're referring.
How are you with Shakespeare?
Well, in what sense? I did a little here and there. My very first job was Two Gents, a musical version of Two Gentlemen of Verona, written by Galt McDermott, who did Hair.
When was
and
this?
John Guare, who adapted
John
the
Guare,
Shakespeare.
John Guare, who did the Atlantic City.
House of Blue Leaves. Oh, Atlantic City with Susan Sarandon.
Yes, sir.
With, who was in that movie that I was just about to refer to with Burr Steers, because he wrote and directed this movie called Igby Goes Down.
Yes.
So Susan Sarandon or Sarandon?
Yeah, Sarandon,
whichever,
I think, right?
Whichever she prefers. Well, I've heard both. I guess it's Sarandon. It's
she was in here for a minute.
What?
Yeah, that was good.
I'll bet it was. She's delightful. I love her. What did she say and what did you say?
She's very, I guess it's the term that you would use and I think you can still use is free-spirited.
She's free spirited
in a very true sense that, you know, you get the sense that like, oh, she'll talk about anything. I wish I had more time. You know, it was one of those things where she had to be somewhere and they came a little late. And I just realized talking to her, I'm like, she'd talk about anything.
Really?
But
even publicly. So you got the sense.
She's just not ashamed of anything. And she owns her past proudly. All of it.
Isn't that interesting? I don't know.
It's rare.
All about her past. Chris Sarandon, you know, was in Two Gents.
Yes.
Listen to this and how this doubles back on itself. Chris Sarandon was in Two
With
Gents.
With you.
Yeah, once we went to Broadway out of the Joe Papp's Delacorte Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to Broadway, and he was in it for a time. So was Stockard Channing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
She turned out to be a real stage actress.
She certainly did.
And she can belt out a tune, right?
She's got a good set of pipes. I play piano, you know, so I played
piano. I
saw
you at the memorial. It was very touching when we walked in at Gary's memorial.
You were there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Is it me or is somebody knocking on our door?
Yes. Hello?
Maybe there's a wildfire out, blazing out, about to consume us. Oh, he's paying the pizza delivery? Oh, this must be the housekeeper. She seemed delightful. What's her name?
Lupe.
Lupe seems delightful.
I've never talked about her on the microphones.
Really?
Yeah, she's very delightful. And
she seems delightful.
She's very wonderful. Yeah. And she comes once a week. And I'm not even that much of a pig, but it's a pleasure. For years, I never thought, I remember when I was married, and this might be part of the reason I'm not, that the wife at that time would say, you know, maybe we should have someone come in and clean. I'm like, we're not those people. We're not people who need cleaning people. Right. We're, you know, this is a small house.
Right.
And I didn't do that. She was also the woman who said, we should get central air. I'm like, that sounds like a hassle. It's a small house. It's not hot for that many months.
Ooh.
In retrospect, had I done both of those things, which I eventually did, perhaps I would still be married.
Really?
If I'd stopped yelling. There's other issues, Jim.
Oh, boy. I want to hear everything.
Oh, you do?
Yes, yes, I do.
So wait, Two Gents.
Two Gents.
So wait, where did you grow up?
Shakespeare in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Who else is from there? Michael Keaton, my friend Jerry Stahl.
Jerry Stahl.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Jerry Stahl?
The writer of Permanent Midnight.
Oh, Permanent Midnight. Yeah. Ben Stiller.
Yes, he played Jerry Stahl in Permanent Midnight.
I'll be darned.
He grew up in Pittsburgh. I've met a few people from Pittsburgh. I don't have a sense of it as what it might have been like when it was a working class, perhaps city on the decline. It's a little, it's gotten a little influx of money. It seems a little better now.
I guess so. I wonder why. I was just talking last night to somebody. I should go there.
Uh-huh. They should give you a street or something.
Oh, I don't think so.
Goldblum Lane.
Yeah, really.
It's
yeah.
over there by the old mill.
Yeah.
By the old steel processing place.
Mill. Yeah. It was, you know, when I grew up, it was smoky and evocative.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, how'd you end up there? What was the family doing? How'd they land there?
Oh, you know, my dad's dad named Pavartsik from Russia.
Pavartsik?
Yep.
See,
I'm
this
not,
is why.
I'm not Goldblum. I'm Pavartsik.
That's your last name? Pavartsik.
Well, it's not. Was never my last name, but it was. That's the family name. That was my dad's dad's name.
I knew that I got along with you before you got here.
Yeah, me too. You.
It's because we're Russian Jews.
Is that it?
I think
so. You're all Russians because my mom's
Russian
dad
Polish.
Was Austrian.
Oh, that's so my mom's dad from his roots are in Austria.
So we're probably
brothers. We're cousins.
Exactly. But right.
Same genetics. Did you ever get that genetic thing done? I'm getting it done.
Yes.
You did. You got it done?
Well, yes. Very elaborately because we just had a child. I just had my first child. We wanted to get pregnant and we got pregnant with my now beautiful wife, Emily. Goldblum.
Yeah.
And so we got everything that one can do, you know, testing whether we were compatible genetically and all that.
But you did the whole DNA history thing?
That I didn't do just for the sake of...
you go back, you can find the town.
Oh, that I didn't do. Nor have I looked up, you know, roots, anything like tree
right.
roots. So I don't know anything besides the one dad and the other dad. And I don't even know whether they're from Minsk or Pinsk or anything about that.
Right.
So that would be interesting. I should do that. But then, I just saw that you can do a whole DNA thing.
So, okay. So the name again.
The DNA. So Pavartsik.
Pavartsik.
Yeah. And then we just had this child who was born Independence Day, by the way, Charlie Ocean.
Is he a year?
He'll be a year in
July 4th.
4th of July.
And your movie comes out.
The events of the movie happen on the 2nd, 3rd,
that's
4th
right.
of July.
It's all coming together. Somehow, if we can tie the two gents into this, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be one of those serendipitous interviews.
We're the two gents.
Yes,
we
are. Oh, that's right.
Gents.
That's right. And we're speaking not regular non-Shakespearean English.
Yeah. That's right. You know who but we're kind of hip hoppy. You know, which is the new Shakespeare. You know who the two gents were. I wonder which one you'd be. One is called Valentine and one is called Proteus. Is that it? Yeah.
I don't know. Is it a good cop, bad cop? Is it a comedy team situation where there's a doofus and a straight man? How does it work?
Oh, I like that. Doofus. Oh, you mean just doofus. You don't mean Goofus and Gallant. You know who Goofus and Gallant is? That's who we should play.
Comic strip, wasn't it?
No, it was kind of those children's kind of magazines
that you'd see
in offices. And one would goof, Gallant would do all the right things. Goofus would do all the wrong things.
So Goofus was the doofus.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you are a poet, and you don't know it, but your feet show it. Can you finish that?
No.
They're Longfellows.
Oh, okay.
Now, you're, of course, wearing sandals.
It's hot, Jeff. It's hot.
No, you don't have to be ashamed of anything, just
I'm
like Susan Sarandon.
These aren't Birkenstocks, and they're, you know, I've committed to them.
Yeah, they're very, very beautiful.
Thank you.
There's nothing wrong with... a lot of people think that an adult
You're getting
man...
a lot out of me. The cleaning lady and the sandals. This interview is moving more in your direction than mine.
No.
You're getting it out of me.
I like...
All the secrets.
I'll tell you everything. I'm an open-faced sandwich, you know.
An open-faced Reuben.
Yeah, I'd love a Reuben sandwich. I haven't had that in a million years.
You're scared of it?
Well, it's not exactly on my bullseye regime.
Yeah, well, do you ever treat yourself? You seem to be fairly healthy to the point where it looks like you spend a little time doing it.
Yeah, a little time. I do it. I'm conscientious. I kind of put in my time. But I sure like... And I cheat here and there. I would... If I thought that Reuben sitting in front of us, if there was one, was the best one, you know, it shouldn't be missed, I'd have a bite or two of it. But can you imagine hot... I remember when I first... I think my mom and I went out for a date.
In Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
They had a deli?
Someplace. I'd said, what's a Reuben sandwich?
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I first discovered. She said, oh, it's a thing. You know, it's open face. It's got sauerkraut. It's hot. I think melted cheese. Melted Swiss cheese. Oh. Try it. Really? Yeah. And then it came. Oh my God. Thousand Island dressing. I love food. I loved it then and I love it now.
A similar experience with a Reuben where it was like, this is amazing.
Really?
You know, with the other deli item that, like, you know, that sort of changed my life with my grandmother would take me was diner rice pudding. The
now
creamy
you're talking
kind.
My language. Oh man. Oh Jesus. That right? might be my, if I was going to be executed, that might be right. on the,
with
on
a
the
little
menu.
Bit of cinnamon and some of the top that gets a little, you know, tough.
Oh my God.
Right?
That's delicious.
You can't get it. It's hard to find. Like really? The Mexicans have a version of it, of that very specific rice pudding. Mm-hmm. I've made it at home. It's not baked. It's done on the stovetop, you know, where it thickens with the sugar and the actual rice.
Oh, yeah.
But in the diner, you'd go in and you could look in the window, in the trays, and you'd see it at the bottom, like, they got it. It'd be like rice pudding, tapioca pudding, and maybe some bread pudding.
I love tapioca pudding. I love bread pudding. How about at Musso and Frank's, they have diplomat pudding, which is, I think, only there, which is bread pudding with some extra, like, raspberry sauce on it. You're the diplomat, then.
Yeah.
If you have... Yeah.
You're important.
I think if I had a show business title...
Yeah.
Couldn't I be the diplomat?
Sure, yes.
That's not taken, is it?
No, you know, you're
Frank
very
Sinatra,
diplomatic.
I'm not the chairman of the board.
No.
I'm not the king.
You can be the diplomat.
I might be the diplomat.
They should do it in your intro when you play music. Please welcome the diplomat, Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
So you're in Pittsburgh eating Reubens with your mother in an unknown deli.
Yes.
And your father's father was from Russia and had a beautiful name, which was...
Pivartsik.
Pivartsik. Yeah. And your grandfather did what? Was he in dry goods?
Oh,
Schmattas?
You know, he came over here. My dad was sort of... Well, let's not get into that. But he,
no,
but
let's Joseph, just a little. Give me a sense of
well,
what we're not
you know,
getting
he
into.
He was not so. I think in that generation of American Jews, they wanted to assimilate.
Right, pass.
And, yeah.
How do you pass? Get rid of that name.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he had Goldblum. Luckily, he didn't. I'm glad he didn't. You know, bastardize it anymore. But I think his dad, who had a little candy store and sold some luggage, didn't really want to learn to drive and that kind of stuff.
So he had a store with bags and
bags and
luggage.
And some candy. I never saw it. I met Tut,
candy.
Tut, we called him, you know, Tut,
sure.
Tut killer,
yeah.
Joe Goldblum. But he was there. We didn't go over and visit them much. And Bubby, you know, Lillian.
Because your dad didn't want to.
Well, didn't want to. And then he had a younger brother, Chucky.
Yeah.
Who died? Who he loved? Who was a big? Who looked like me?
Yeah.
Was my height?
Yeah.
And was a basketball star in Westminster College, and where there's many clippings one could see
in Pennsylvania.
I don't know where it was. And would have been in the NBA.
Really?
They said, yep. And then he volunteered for World War II. And he went, his plane went down and never found.
Oh.
Chucky. And that's why we named our boy Charlie.
Your son.
His name,
your new
yes,
son.
After Chucky, believe
great.
It or not. Yeah. But so his family, he would always be a little, his mom, we'd go over to their house.
Your grandparents.
My grandparents. He didn't like the smell so much. And
oh, right, right, right.
You know.
My parents were sort of the same. You'd go back and you'd see, have this window into their past, but it was like, and that was really the birth of what we know as American Jews, of that thing. That's why we know what Kishka is. That's why we know what Kasha is.
Yeah.
That's why we know, you know, that these deli things that allowed arguments. There's great scenes in... Like in Annie Hall, which you were in for an amazing second.
Thank you.
You know, the families, so going back to Coney Island, that, you know, that narrative has been sort of really kind of explored.
His father, Woody Allen's father, as a kid in that movie, is played by Mordecai Lawner.
Yeah.
Who studied with Sandy Meisner, taught that method, and wound up in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University. And I took a 6-week summer course between 9th and 10th and 10th, 11th grades. And that was the first exposure I had to something like the Sandy Meisner improvisational method.
With that actor, Mordecai.
Yes, with Mordecai Lawner, who was teaching. Yes.
And she's poor. She could steal from us.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
Yeah.
That's right. That's the wonderful Mordecai Lawner. But we were, let's backtrack.
Yeah.
Get out of this cul-de-sac. So we'd go back and... They had pictures of Chucky Goldblum, and And they said, oh, he was never found, but he's going to come back.
Oh, they believed that.
And my dad was always like kind of mad and
well, maybe that was
ashamed.
Another reason why he didn't like to go over there. Was that, you know, this sort of like the grief mixed with the expectation.
There was plenty of subterranean.
Judging him against the dead one.
Yes, unexcavated all lots of things, I'm sure, that were hidden in the Jewish David Lynchian way, you know, just under the surface. And then when I started to play, looked like his brother, started to play basketball myself. I was kind of athletic.
Yeah.
And then went into acting. He wanted to be, they said he said he wanted to either be to get himself out of this condition and to rise up and to be an American. He was going to either be a doctor.
Your father.
As one did, or an actor. Mm. He got into his head, stuck his head in the back of...
Those are the options.
Yes. Stuck his head in the back of a class of Carnegie Tech, which was then called Carnegie Mellon University, and said, he then reported to us, that it was out of my league, he said, whatever that meant.
Right.
But so, you know, fast forward, me being titillated by it, very inspired.
Did he go into show business?
He did not, no.
What did he do?
He was a doctor.
Your dad was a doctor.
He was a doctor.
So he took a little...
Look at the class.
That's so funny, because the doctor, one is strongly condoned by the Jewish elders.
Yes.
The other is like, what are you doing?
Yes, except if you make it, as Philip Roth says,
right.
You know, in Portnoy's Complaint, I think, it's even better than a doctor if you're on the Johnny Carson.
Sure.
You know, hey, look, he was on the Johnny, that's him.
That was the only way they knew you were popular.
Yeah, something like that.
It's very funny now with so many different TV outlets, like to the point where like I've got 4 seasons of a TV show and I still got a father who's like, I don't get it. I don't know where to watch it.
Right.
Do I get it?
Can you imagine? Really? Your dad does that? Where is he? In New Jersey?
No, he's in New Mexico.
New Mexico?
No one's in New Jersey anymore.
What's he doing in New Mexico now? Well, that's where we shot Independence Day, in Albuquerque.
Yeah, I grew up in Albuquerque.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's where I spent this last year ago, this summer.
Well, they got that great facility there now, the studio.
That's where we were.
Yeah.
In those big sound stages. Yeah. We had 5 or 6 of those enormous sound stages.
Yeah, yeah.
But no kidding, you grew up there. Didn't Gary Shandling grow? He was in Phoenix, Arizona. But
Southwestern Jews.
Southwestern Jews.
You got brothers and sisters?
Yes. Well, there were 4 of us originally. Not unlike my dad, my brother, whom I adored, 4 years older than me, Rick, died when he was 23.
Oh.
Unfortunately, in 1970.
How?
He was a kind of a truth seeker, an adventurer, and a Hemingway-esque, you know, wannabe writer.
But that was a 60s thing.
That's right. You get the idea. And he was traveling around. He was in North Africa, like Casablanca, Agadir, Morocco.
Yeah.
And
doing the beatnik thing.
Yes, kind of hippie, early hippie, beatnik, kind of bumming around on a beach kind of thing. Got a quick something or other and died very quickly.
Of a disease.
Shockingly, yep.
A virus, a bacteria.
Something like that.
No kidding.
Yeah, kidney failure finally. Yeah.
It's horrible.
Horrible.
You were like 20?
I was 19. He was 23.
And he was the guy that was guiding you through.
Well, yes,
the life.
That's right.
The music.
He moved out of the house, you know, and got a kind of a pad in Pittsburgh. Was in college and was starting to talk funny and talked about in 1960. What was this, 7 or something like that? Counterculture. What's that counterculture? And then. I went over to his place and he put on, I think, one of the Beatles albums that just come out, like the, not the White Album, I'll bet this was Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
And put that on and we smoked hash.
Yeah.
Which was probably powerful, and I'd never done anything, so it was like tripping.
Were you
later.
Sort of a nerdy, athletic kid?
I played ball. I was, you know, athletic. I was good, but I was never on a team. But I played all day, all along with my neighborhood friends, every sport. I liked that. But I was already playing piano and kind of interested in acting, maybe, and But he turned me on to all that. And girl, you know, he was already kind of a handsome guy and, you know, with the girls. So, he was kind of guiding me. I looked up to him terrifically. So then he died. I went to New York.
Horrible.
And I was in this Broadway show. I was in 2 Gents on Broadway when I got this horrible news. And then there's my other brother, Lee, who was around until a couple of years ago, died finally at 60. Yeah, he was 5 years older than me. He kind of was back in Pittsburgh, very close to my mom and We could talk about him, but a very sweet, sweet guy. And then there's my sister, who's still around, 2 years younger, Pam.
Yeah.
A wonderful girl, a painter, very wonderful artist who paints with her husband, Jeffrey Kaiserschott, another painter. And they both teach at this point. Very.
I'm dating a painter. Too. Painters are an interesting people.
Really? Mm-hmm. You are. I think so, too. You're. How long have you been going with this?
A couple years almost.
What's her name?
Sarah Kane.
Sarah Kane.
Yeah, she's preparing for a show in New York in September.
Really?
Yeah, at La Longue, Gallery La Longue.
And what kind of stuff does she paint?
Abstract, big.
Really?
Like things that are in, just like, where does that come from? Like, very impressive.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Does she, doesn't live here?
Yeah, she does.
Oh, she does?
She lives down the street.
Oh, really?
Kind of, yeah.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, and sometimes not. But you've only been going together for 2 years.
Yes.
What could be going wrong so far?
I'm crazy.
I'm crazy.
What always goes wrong?
So crazy after all these years. I love that song. Yeah. That's kind of a touching song, isn't
very.
It?
Very. Well, Neil, he's a good artist, Paul Simon.
He is.
Does all right for himself.
He sure does. And we had a chance to, you know, shoot the breeze a little bit at one
did
of these
you?
Things we did. Yeah, a little shared charity event that I did where I played the piano. And he's very open and available. We got talking about every little thing in the time we had.
Also in Annie Hall.
Yes, exactly.
And not far from where you were. You must have had
our
scenes.
I'm in the same scene. The same
at his house.
Little, that's right. It's his house. The shot, your tracking shot goes by him, and he's showing Woody Allen around and his girlfriend. And then it stops on me at the end of the scene.
I
forgot my mantra on the phone. That's right. That's right. But how do we get
you delivered
into
it so Jeff Goldblum-like.
Oh, thank you. How do we get into there? Wait a minute, Paul.
So your mom's still around?
Oh, so you're crazy after all these years. Yeah. That's right.
Your
mom. My mom knew. My dad died in 83 at the age of 63.
Oh, my God.
That's right. Big heart attack. Like many males in our family, my mom's dad died in his 40s or 50s.
Oh,
I never
boy.
Met him. Sam Tomelis. And then Joe Goldblum, Pavarczyk. Goldblum died, you know.
Heart attack was a thing.
Big heart attack. Yeah, heart. So I'm taking care of that kind of thing. I remember.
How's the cholesterol?
You know, I do everything I can, and I think it's good.
You got the genetic thing though, like a little high.
Yeah.
Me too.
Oh, yeah. It needs to be. Mm-hmm. I need to do everything I can to make sure I'm doing good. I was at his funeral, of course. I remember his funeral when my grandfather's.
Oh, Joe.
Joe. When I was very young, 11, 12, you know, and my grandmother, of whom I spoke, who thought Chucky was always gonna
come back.
They said it was in a little, you know, wherever it was, funeral home thing, and somebody spoke. My dad didn't speak. It wasn't like Gary Shandling's Hollywood big beautiful production. It was a little thing, and there was a screen, and behind the screen was the casket. And then did we go back and see it? And then I think they said, all right, Lillian, his wife, can come back and see it. And she went around. My dad was sitting sort of next to me, maybe. And we hear from behind the screen a wail. My best friend! My best friend! You know, like that. My dad looked sort of ashamed. Sort of ashamed, but moved and disturbed and a little ashamed. It was more of a scene, I think, than he wanted at that point. And then we went on to the grave site.
Yeah.
And as the casket was being lowered down, Lillian started to wail again, I think, my best friend, and started to try to climb into the hole and needed to be restrained.
So sad.
It was sad, shocking, alarming, and I think to my dad, also disturbing.
Emotions. So he was not a yeller or an emotional guy? Or?
My dad was not, no, he was not a, he was kind of a very authentic, real sort of guy with a big work ethic. Lovely. We'd go to the Steelers games all the time.
What kind of doctor?
Internal medicine practitioner.
Bag.
He had a bag. He'd go to people's houses.
Right.
Still made house calls. That kind of things. Patients loved him, I think.
Yeah.
My mom was kind of a, bombastic, vivacious, and
had
a
mom.
Had a temper, yes, and would be dramatical and histrionic here.
What'd
and there.
What'd she do?
Ooh, she raised us four kids, and then took off after we left, was a sex therapist, so the legend has it, and for a time, and went back to college and had a radio show and or something like that.
They you separated?
Know. No. They stayed together. And she was she wanted to be in show business early on.
Yeah.
So she was a kind of an actressy type. Showy type.
Funny?
Well,
hard to know.
Complicated.
Too close.
Complicated and dark and
oh yeah,
and storms. Yes, yeah. very, very big weather. Lots of weather there. Uh-huh. Big weather patterns.
Uh-huh.
My dad was less like that as you
didn't
asked.
Have to be.
Yes,
sometimes
yes.
That's the way it goes. It's like there's one that sits while the other one spins.
Yigs, that was more like that. Although sometimes he'd blow.
Oh yeah,
he'd blow.
Yeah,
hear him blow, and when you know, you could see when he was, and then you know, he'd whip off his belt. Sometimes he wouldn't, beat his. Yeah, but the threat was always there. You
the
know,
belt.
That. I mean, I can't imagine. We have an 11-month-old. You know, the hysterical chaos with four kids. I don't know how you do it, but you know, it's not that he beat us. I'm not saying that. But anyway, he was wonderful. But. After Rick died, if I'm not being too personal, after Rick died, now he was, you know, Rick was 23 and he was, you know, whatever, he's younger than me now. He was in his 50s or something like that. He would take to bursting into tears unexpectedly.
Yeah.
Bursting into tears. I also saw him burst into tears when he saw me act on stage.
He burst into tears?
Yes. I did a play early on in my 20s at the Phoenix Theater.
Where's that?
City show in New York City. Yeah. It was a kind of, you know.
He came up.
Pedigreed, yeah. They came down to see that pedigreed kind of New York off-Broadway theater, and it was a premiere of a Stephen Polyakov play. I had the lead part. I was on the radio. I played a disc jockey from Liverpool or something, and so I had a dialect, and it was a showy part, and I worked hard on it. And afterwards, and this is already after he'd seen Nashville, the Robert Altman movie, and he said something like, "Your dad," he said, "he was what were you doing in that movie? What was I didn't get your part, you know, et cetera, et cetera." So I was like, "Oh,
I was the guy in the bike."
Yeah. I was like, "Oh boy, you don't get it, you know." Jesus, yeah. I was, you know,
right?
Mad in a lot of ways, but he came back after that show, burst into tears, and threw his arms around me.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
You did it.
Well, something like, I don't know. I hit a chord in him. He wanted to be an actor and all that stuff.
He's proud of you. That's what you
did. Yeah, he was very proud of me.
Yeah.
Hey, do you like that play, Death of a Salesman?
Yeah.
I think, Arthur, I almost met Arthur Miller once, but that family, I love that play. And I think
the Dustin Hoffman, John Malkovich one? Oh, my God.
I loved that.
It was great.
I've seen Lee J. Cobb on stage, but he was the original.
You saw him on stage?
No, I didn't.
You saw him in the movie?
But there's a one can get it. You can get that, you know.
Lee J. Cobb was such a fucking monumental kind of presence.
He sure was. I wish I'd see. Well, you can see him in that. My dad saw him in King Lear. They used to go to New York to see theater, and they'd come back with
an angry Jewish Lear.
Yes. He went, and then he said, listen to this. He said he met him on the street. He ran into him. He had a celebrity.
Your dad did.
My dad did. Went up to him and said, "Mr. Cobb, I just wanted to tell you, I saw your King Lear the other day, and it was just wonderful." And he said, and when he told this story, and he told it many times, several times, he said, Lee J. Cobb, at that compliment, burst into a kind of smile that was full of joy, he thought. So he was remarking on, the point of the story was how much he loved doing it and how proud he was and how much he appreciated hearing this, you know, like that. And he's the one, my dad said, you know, if you find something you really love to do, that's your vocational guidepost. And that's why I'm doing this. That's really when I figured out, when I had an experience or two, when I thought, hey, I really love this. That's what I'll do. That's why I put two and two together.
He's a very sensitive guy, despite himself, your father.
he was a very sensitive guy. Yes, he had a of that era and of that generation, a kind of restraint and some difficulties and challenges. But he was, of course, very, he had an art in him in a way, and very, very sensitive.
So, so you decide your vocation is, you know, you're there in Pittsburgh, you're playing basketball, you've got a brother that kind of opens your mind, you got a mother who's kooky but compelling, a dad who's reluctantly supportive.
Yeah, well, they were both finally, okay. I mean, he thought, academics, go to college and all that, but I got into this school at 17, Neighborhood Playhouse, Sandy Meisner, he didn't know him, but...
That's where you went, you auditioned for that?
You didn't audition. You just met Sandy Meisner.
And you went and met him. And you took a trip from,
took a train. My mom helped me. Well, she drove. What did we do?
You're 17.
We must have flown.
Yeah.
Because we'd driven. We'd taken many road trips to Miami Beach. We went to the Fountain Blue Hotel once.
Sure.
Mostly went to Atlantic City. Of course, you New Jerseyan.
So you don't know if you drove or you flew, but you go to New York and you're meeting with Sanford
Meisner. Yeah, I met Sandy Meisner.
Why'd you find him? What drove you to that school?
Well, and the interesting that you should ask, Mordecai Lawner.
Oh, the guy who you went to the summer school.
Summer school. I auditioned for Carnegie Mellon University. It was the only place. A good acting school. It's the only. I fell in love with it, acting. Every morning on the shower door, I would write, please God, let me be an actor. And that was a secret, so I'd wipe it off. But I was obsessed with it, so I auditioned for that school, and I failed. I didn't get in. They rejected me. So I scrambled around, and Mordecai Lawner, I did a probably horrible audition. In fact, I did a scene from Death of a Salesman. I did Biff, who's having a midlife crisis at 35. I didn't understand. I couldn't have understood that at all.
Yeah.
I'm sure I was horrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Mordecai Lawner said, well, you might want to check out this school where I taught, and Sandy Meisner, he's the best. Anyway, that's how I found myself recommended there, and I had a meeting with him, and he accepted me.
What was that like? I mean, Sanford Meisner was part of the, was he part of the group theater? Was he part? Right.
Oh, yeah.
With Clifford Odets and
Stella Adler. And Stella Adler. Lee Strasberg, Harold Plurman.
Yes. A real purpose, a populist theater movement.
Oh, if you haven't read about that for years. Yeah, that was a big part of that. That. And I think Sandy Meisner came out of that and formed this teaching method.
What was your impression of Meisner as a 17-year-old?
He was an impressive, wonderful a figure of serious substance and imbued you with, how worthwhile and serious and beautiful this life endeavor could be. It was something, and he was so deep and authentic and already kind of realized in a way. But you know what he was?
What?
He was also had his own problems. I studied him over the years. I taught that technique for years, so I have my own convictions about many aspects of that. But listen to this, because I know a little bit about our shared connection in this way. You know who was in my class in 1970? Jonathan Katz. Because we both did Dr.
I didn't know
Katz.
That about him.
Yes. Now listen to this. Jonathan Katz was in that class. He could also be, what I was going to say is Meisner could be fierce and kind of cruel. He was always frightening. You either had to get on the high wire and do this thing. It wasn't fooling around. It wasn't Hollywood acting class type stuff where you came in from surfing and was like, hey, I'll toss this off.
Right.
You were either,
in it or not.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It was a serious endeavor. Jonathan Katz was in the class. After a couple of months, he said, all right, Katz, let's see your thing. Jonathan did this thing. He started his improvisation with his so-called independent activity. He was not doing really what Meisner wanted at that point. Obviously, he stopped it. I think he slammed his hand on the desk or something. He was quick triggered.
Yeah.
Even all his demeanor was always a kind of a lesson in how hot and available one could be, kind of thing. But so he said, stop right there. He said, you've been, Jonathan Katz, you've been hiding for 3 months now or something like that.
Yeah.
And now you do tell me what you're doing. What are you doing? Explain this activity. He says, I'm trying to think of remember all the dead people I've ever touched, which did not fulfill the assignment really for what we were getting at. Meisner started to steam like Brando in One Eyed Jacks or something. And he said, you listen to me. You've been hiding now for 3 months and now you come up with this. take your things, get out of here. You're out. At that point, you could feel your blood chill. Everyone sitting there as Jonathan pathetically gathered up his things and walked to the door and got out. And that was the last we saw of him. And you can bet we all we redoubled our efforts to, you know, do whatever we were doing.
Well, what was
it? It was cruel. And it was, I believe, it was a little misguided. I mean, it worked on us, if that's what he intended. And Jonathan Katz, because I ran into him later. And then I did the show. He said, you know, I quit after that. I never did anything for 2 decades or something. And then I'm doing that. You know, Mr. Meisner missed that he was an interesting and resourceful, and he had something to offer that might have needed a little nurturing. I do believe currently.
Well, I admit, but I don't think Meisner saw that as his job, and it infuriated him, because I think that, you know, that standard that was set by Meisner and Strasberg for acting classes, where you defer to this guru, this emotional wizard, to sort of reveal yourself and trust the environment, that, you know, they can tell if you're fucking around and you're not willing to take the risks. And for whatever reason that you can't, it's not their goddamn responsibility.
Well, I hear what you're saying. I that's also correct. You're both right. I'm the diplomat.
The truth of the matter is that if you access the emotions necessary, that doesn't in and of itself guarantee that you're going to be a good actor.
No.
And there's some other combination of things, but in order to get to that place to do the work, if you've got what it takes, is sort of necessary within this structure.
Yeah.
And you believe in this structure.
Yeah.
Well, what is this? What is the Meisner? What is the method?
Well,
I've talked to some people about it, and I joke about it, that, you know, when I knew people that were just taking classes and not necessarily in the school, that I think was when Meisner had already passed, that we became available for sort of weekend warriors and whatnot to just take a class, but not be immersed in the in the method, that the Meisner method was the repetition thing.
It's sometimes misunderstood as only that.
Well, it gets hacked like that. That's my experience of it.
That's
like
right.
Green.
Green, 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 green. Yeah, but that's not it. I think it's misunderstood as that. It's here's in a nutshell. I can't possibly give it any justice, but let me see if I can be clear in a second, in a very pithy second. First of all, acting, I think he's, well, it's instinctive. He called it living truthfully under imaginary circumstances.
Okay.
Like Harold Clurman's book, Lies Like Truth. It really only means just pretend, but pretend good.
Yeah.
That's really what you're doing. So how do you do that? He had a foundational program that lasted a couple of years, the first part of which was set up so that his signature distinguishing feature that he really contributed, this improvisation, came at the beginning. So it was the beginning of this pretending good business, living truthfully under imaginary circumstances, whereby...
I like that.
Yeah, whereby you had to start to... The improvisation became finally an improvised exercise where you're under imaginary circumstances and you have an authentic living experience where you're present and open, and you live out this made-up situation. This business of working off the other person and your connection with the other person that is part of this and part of this technology of this is like skating is to hockey.
Mm-hmm.
You can't play the hockey game until you know how to skate. So until you know how to go moment to moment, so to speak, where you can be, where you really train yourself to be attentive, available, and to the other guy mostly, but everything that's going on around you.
That's you're the not tricky just part.
That's what you're training. There's a technology for that, and he kind of developed this thing that begins with this repetition. So that's the first part of it. This communication under imaginary circumstances. The second part, that's the incoming, where you listen. You can listen so attentively that you can repeat exactly what the other guy said. As a matter of fact, you can communicate to him what you got besides what he said.
Yeah.
Here's the way you said it.
Yeah.
And all the nuances thereof.
Right.
And then before you go on, you're part of the tennis, when the ball is on your side of the court, you say, here's how you put the ball to me. Here's what I just got from you. And here's how I send it back, because this is how I feel about, I'm going to now communicate to you in word or deed how I feel about what you've just said or how you've just said it.
Right.
In which demands that you open yourself up. So it causes you to be at once present and train yourself to be present and open and connect to your unique channel of communicativeness.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. That's a pretty good start. You're listening and you're answering. And that starts to solve the problem of when you got a script. Hey, let's pretend that I've never heard this before. And I'm going to take it in. And I'm going to let your pinch produce an ouch in me that now generates what I have to do back to you. That's kind of how life goes. And so it sort of simulates that under the imaginary circumstances. So it's very good in our world. It teaches you how to improvise, which is very useful in all kind of jobs that you may get. But it also gives you technology that supplies the underpinnings of Wes Anderson script or Shakespeare or Chekhov or David Mamet, where you got to say the words, but have an alive experience and play the game of acting, which is this is like real life. I'm going to listen to you and be available to you. And even if nothing different happens,
okay, well,
and give it back to you, pinching and ouching, and then play the whole game and make a pretend a scene out of it.
Well,
you get the idea?
I do, and it makes sense to me, and I appreciate all of that, and I've always felt that those things were important, to be emotionally present and open and listening and engaged with the other person. Now, I'm no trained actor, but I've done some acting lately, and I've gotten better at it. And the trick is that you can do all those things, but eventually you have to be comfortable.
Yes.
So, like, you know, being present, you know, is good. But, you know, to appreciate the space that you're in. And then, you know, because like the thing that always drops off for me when you tell me that is like, all right, you're pretending. But OK, so you're in a house and it's 1920.
Yes.
And, you know, how much do you take in? How do you register? What technology do you use, you know, outside of being present for the pinching and ouching to place yourself in an environment or say where when you're on a film to return back after a 3-day a scene on an airplane to the emotions that are necessary to play the rest of the scene before you get on the airplane. Like what are the tools that you use for being in the actual environment that you're pretending to be in other than the emotional connection and the pinching and ouching and also returning back to the emotional state necessary to pick up where you left off in film or television work?
Well, you're talking about many different things. First of all, the second year so-called of the Meisner technique, that first, the improvisation and some improvisatory ways of handling early scene work is part of the first year. The second work is basically, in my view, kind of what Stella Adler was doing, which is understand the material. Now, let's understand the play and do the play, do the show and make it interesting and make it good, which involves, fully realizing the situation.
This is the desert.
Yeah, where if this is 1920, really, she would talk about, you know, understanding the music that you might be listening to then, you know, really all of that. Doing whatever you have
suggestions,
to do.
Right.
If you're in another time.
But I guess only you know whether you really did that or not. And sometimes it doesn't matter if you're pretending well enough.
Yeah, there's no formula to it, you know.
No
formula to it. And the other piece of the other thing you referred to, this requires what some people call emotional preparation, where if you're, where you're going to pick up from a scene where you just found out some horrible news or some wonderful news, and you just got to start right there.
Yeah.
You have to possibly generate in yourself.
Take the second.
Pick it up there. Yeah. It's a very individual thing.
Yeah.
And after experimenting for several decades with that, one can overemphasize preparation and trying to generate things. The more I do it, I'm still conscientious and prepare in many ways. But you can, the given circumstances, like Stanislavski said, are kind of all you need, at least for me at this point. I don't like to go astray too much and bring music in with me and read a book and go astray and spend all morning trying to get myself in a condition. I'm more self-trustful at this point.
Right.
And that can be overemphasized, as that improvisation can be overemphasized, whereby some first year Meisner students can go, that's it, this feels so good, this is all I want to do, and they'll never figure out how to learn lines and make them sound like improvisation or do the show good and understand the author's intent.
Right. A lot of it, let's be honest, is either you got it or you don't.
Well, there's that too. And it, yeah. And it means, yeah, you might have, you either have a flair for it or not.
Yeah.
And part of that flair is, do you have an appetite? Do you really want to do it?
Right.
Are you crazy about doing it? And that's, that's part of it.
So it seems to me, in looking at, the bulk of work, which is a lot, you've done a lot of work, but you certainly paid your fucking dues. In terms of, like, you're in New York, you're doing Meisner, you get the play, you get the Nashville movie, you obviously got an agent, but you're doing whatever you can to get on camera.
Yeah, yeah. I did. Well, it kind of happened luckily. I mean, I got the first thing and the second thing, and one thing led to another.
But, Death Wish was small.
It was very small, but it was the first audition I ever went on.
Uh-huh.
And that led to something else, and that led to something else. And I was lucky because I didn't know what I was doing. Meisner says it takes 20 years to be of real work to even call yourself an actor, and then a lifelong experience. I'm a late bloomer, and I'm a humble student, and I kind of follow that credo, and I'm still learning. And I got lucky that I got chances to learn on the job, and lucky that it was just little.
Yeah,
I didn't know what I was doing, and it wasn't. I'm still learning now. I'll tell you, on the set last year, I found out a lot of things that have transformed my work. Yep.
Like what?
Well, this business about overemphasizing preparation. I was still a little addicted to, a year ago, overemphasizing for myself, working too hard on getting myself into a condition and or distract myself or free myself so that when I had the moment of the scene, I was a little surprised or a little bit fresh or a little bit something that I thought, or a little bit alive, more alive than I thought I should be.
Yeah.
And I would drink a little bit of coffee too, which is not the worst thing in the world, but I've given that all up. In the last year, no coffee. This is me, no coffee. And I don't drink it now. I was not drinking too much of it, but it's like even the smallest kind of extra stimulation or performance enhancement, I kind of don't want to do now.
Okay.
It's just better for me. I kind of trust more than ever my own bones and blood and somehow and the scene.
And you just
and my ability
that.
To solve the scene in the moment. I still prepare from the day I get the part and try to figure out what to do to make it good on the day.
Yeah.
But when I get there, I don't want any books in my pocket or other, you know, conversation that I'm going to try to, you know, free myself or unnecessary, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think it's great. I think it seems that maybe Meisner was right. It takes at least 20 years, if not
for
more.
For me, you know, if he set me up like that, I dig it. I'm glad. Hey, if I'd figured all this out in the first couple of years, I think I'd be bored or doing something else. Now. I'm still excited because I want another opportunity now to try out my new, better self.
Yeah. That comfort in your own skin, you know, is beautiful for you as an artist. But also, you always had your own time zone. That you're one of those guys that, you know, you know, just by your nature, you know, you have a way of phrasing, you have a way of being, you have a way of taking information. And even when you walked into my house, you know, you took things in and I'm like, he's being so Jeff Goldblum, you know, like that it's purely you. And I think as an artist of any kind, you want to arrive there. You want to be comfortable enough to go, you know, I know who I am.
Yeah, well, Meisner said, don't copy anybody. Just figure out how you can do it uniquely. He said that, so I think I took that to heart. I've tried to pursue that. And yeah, I just got, I think I was lucky somehow. And again, I got a toehold in something that was nourishing and kind of followed it.
That's the other thing you hear a lot about, choices, making choices. Mm. It seems like that Meisner was not too hung up on that.
Well, that's right. I think his, like I say, distinguishing contribution was that first year that sort of opens you up. This is a very good method of really.
And then you do what you're going to do.
And then it kind of, his second year, it's less distinctive, I think. It's more like what everybody else is trying to do, make it good, Stella Adler, make good choices and figure out how to do it, make it interesting. And so, you know, he would kind of like, hey, you figure it out, you know, do it and do it a lot and you'll figure out how to make it good. I like the other part. If you try to get through, you know, a play, really your whole adult career without doing that second part, it's like, as somebody said, trying to cross the Atlantic Ocean with a with a mixmaster strapped to your patoot, you know.
I think that second part is also, it's on the actor to integrate how they're going to bolster their personal craft. That, you know, like a system is only going to be a system to a certain degree, whereas like what you're basically saying to me is as you move through it and do as much work as you have, you're going to, you know, figure out your own means to get to these things. And also, like for me, the idea of making a choice, you know, once you get the emotions in place, and even in the small amount of acting I've done, that you want to stay, keep the emotions in place, but you might want to do a different line read. You might want to take a different action. You might want to surprise yourself in that moment to get the comedy out of it or the emotions out of it. And those are conscious things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, but I imagine that everyone, like The Fly was the big movie. That's, you're carrying the movie. You're the lead. You're the guy. You're the fly. Yeah, yeah. And you're working with Cronenberg and it's insane. Wow. And the makeup is insane. Yeah. And your performance is intense. Yeah. There's like the moment where you're defending your decision, like there's a moment there where you're angry because, you know, you feel so good that you can't, how can this be wrong? That it was drug addicty.
Eyelashes. You know, like, she says, what's the matter with you? I say, you're jealous. That's what you are. You're jealous. Don't clip my wings. I'm free. Yeah, something like that, or whatever I say. I know. That high moments that could have been good, and I tried to make them good.
They were great. It's a great
thanks,
movie.
Cronenberg. It was, you know, he's good.
Huh? He's got balls.
Yes.
Visionary,
individual, unique.
Yeah, he goes takes chances.
Way, yep. Yeah. And then we were on the jury together at Cannes some years after that, seeing a bunch of interesting movies.
You know? Cannes, is that fun?
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. You know, seeing, I took the assignment seriously. We saw 22 movies in a couple of weeks and talking with interesting people.
In Jurassic Park, you were great. I was very excited about what you did with that character for some reason. Yeah, because I was very aware of the leather jacket. I don't know whose choices those were, but I liked it.
Thank you.
What, were you pointing at yourself?
I was, but then I thought better of it. I'm sure Mr. Spielberg, it was all his design, but he was actually very trustful and very collaborative. Uh-huh. And so I remember when I went in for the costume, saw the costumier, you know, I had my own ideas and had already done a bunch of shopping and said, how about this and this? And I think they took everything I thought it was good.
It was good. He sort of had almost an Elvis element, like a rock star element to it.
Yeah.
And a rebel thing, right?
Well, I knew it was a potentially, you know, what could be described as a, you know, science-y kind of geeky guy, but I wanted to make it as cool as I could.
Sex it up.
Sex it up.
Handsome man.
Scientists are cool. You know? Neil deGrasse Tyson.
They're important and cool.
The real future rests in their hands. I love them.
Also, like you also did like a lot of the 70s television stuff and things. But that was fun, right?
Yeah, it was.
When did you move out here?
I moved out. And so I graduated high school in '70. I went to New York, did that, and then started to do plays. And in 74, I was in New York. And then in 74, came out here after Nashville. Some agent saw me and said, oh, we'll come out here. We'll show you around. And then I never left.
So it was good times then.
Yeah, well, I wish I'd kind of, just like me, you know, as you know, on a movie location, I don't really unwrap the whole city.
Yeah.
But besides my assignment, similarly in New York, can you imagine in New York in 75, I could have gone places that I didn't.
Yeah.
And in L.A. in 75 to 8, you know, I could have gone places I didn't. I had my, you know, feel of the tail of the elephant or the trunk or whatever piece I was feeling, but that's about all. It was interesting.
But I become sort of fascinated with, I talked to Begley of all people, who was phenomenal. I enjoyed talking to him. But I'm sort of fascinated with this town at that time. Like he was around longer.
That's when we met. He and I've been, you know.
Yeah, in the mid 70s, where you know
he was plenty, you know, different.
No, absolutely.
He was drinking up a storm. Yeah.
Sure. No, he definitely talks about it. But there was something about, because when I see you in Altman movies and I see like a, you know, Columbo on your credit sheet, you know, that I feel
Blue,
like the
Blue Knight,
the I'm fascinated George at the time when the business was smaller, the community was smaller, you know, people were out and around. There wasn't this fear of paparazzi everywhere, that you could go out for dinner and you'd see, you know, Nicholson, you go to Dan Tana's, you go, you know, to the rock club, that there was a real sort of a community to it that I romanticized, but it was real, right?
Yeah, I think it was. Like I say, I mean, I had my, you know, little corner of it that I experienced, and it was delightful, you know, running into Ed, being in his circle, and Cindy Williams, you know, at the time, and Fred Roos and Bruno Kirby, you know. Yeah, with whom I became very palsy, you know. What a delightful, wonderful guy he was.
Yeah.
So it was very, very special. It was a special time. We studied with Peggy Fury, if you knew her, and this acting teacher back then.
I don't know her.
Wonderful. Oh, she was just great.
Is Bruno she still around?
Turned me on. No, no, she's not.
So now that you've been married, what, three times?
Yes, I have.
One first kid.
This is the first kid, right?
Yeah.
Now? Yeah, that's right. 11 months old.
You're 10 years older than me or so.
63. Yeah, you're 52.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm 63.
October.
October 22nd.
I'm September 27th.
Ooh.
Libra.
You're a Libra.
Yeah.
Well, you brought it up. There's no credence in astrology.
No, I know that.
Okay. Everyone within the sound of our voice, do they know that too?
Well, we can tell them. But I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm looking for all the similarities. Judd Hirsch played my father as well on the TV show. Yeah.
On what show?
On Marin, on IFC.
Really? He's delightful. I just saw him last night.
Yeah.
He's a model of youthfulness and longevity.
Yeah. Yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, he's very interesting because he can work with all degrees of Jewishness.
Turn it up to 11 or be hardly Jewish
exactly
at all.
yeah we had to we had to turn down the Jew a little that was actually a note.
Can that's
we,
the name of my book.
The
turn down the Jew a little.
How Jewish were you brought up?
Well, like you know, the Coen brothers, you know, Serious Man, 1967. I love that movie. You know, it's barely, we went to this, we were the only Jews in this in West Homestead, where my dad was the doctor to these steel workers' kids, really,
right.
families. And that's who I went to school with. There was one little Orthodox temple. So they sent us there, not really having any interest in it. And we went to Hebrew school and misbehaved there.
Right.
Kind of was our chance to misbehave.
Sure,
and
that's
then
what
I had
it's
a bar mitzvah, so
to make teachers cry. That's what you do at Hebrew school. Try to make teachers cry.
You made your Hebrew teachers?
Two of them, yeah.
Really?
Horrible.
Why? What did you do that made them cry?
Just a smart ass.
I know. It's one of the places I felt freer.
Yeah.
And I felt kind of humorous, too.
Sure.
This old Jewish business made me feel a little bit funny. And but then I had this bar mitzvah that was a little performance-y, and that was kind of fun. But then we never did anything after that.
Right.
And then I developed this sort of yogic kind of interest in the miraculous and all that.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have that still?
Well, a little, a vestige of it. But it's balanced now with a kind of interest in science. If I'm going to expose Charlie to anything, it'll be to Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And, you know, with the real configuration of the universe. Yes, I love poetry, and I love the creative life, which is the unseen and the imaginative and the spirits around us, of course, and all that. But read Carl Sagan's last book, The Demon-Haunted World, that not only says it's foolish to believe in fun, untrue things, but dangerous. So I have been reading Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and Christopher Hitchens and a lot of people like that.
Because you are too much of a romantic?
I'm not. I love my romance. But I'm full of some half-cocked ideas.
Oh, and you wanted clarity.
Yes, sir. I believe so. And it feels like it's right for our moment.
And also it seems like it's informing, like, you know, whatever experience you had about yourself on the set of Independence Day, that, you know, the more clarity you get around what's real and what isn't, and whether or not you're full of shit or not, can only help you be more true to yourself.
Well, that sounds right to me. Or whatever you're talking about, either the circumstances within the movie or me as the actor.
No, by just saying in general, as a person, that if you're calling yourself out on your, you know, bullshit.
Yeah. Well, there's that, yes. Yeah. And then some of these baloney ideas, which are a little airy-fairy, you know, are fine if they feed your gizzard, you know.
Yeah. But not fine for making, you know, global decisions necessarily.
Exactly. We don't want to elect our officials if they're involved in any way.
Based on their yogic practice?
Exactly. Or astrology or, you know.
Conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories. God the ignoramuses, you know, who find themselves in these positions. Yes, who hear from this source and that source. Can you imagine?
You can pick whatever source you want. There's thousands of them now.
Outrageous. You know, learn the facts, my dear fellow.
And you got to search for those sometimes.
Yes. It takes a little effort. Put a little effort into it.
Find the facts.
Find the facts. Yeah. So you know
what
we're talking
about. Not as sexy as the bullshit sometimes.
Sexier. Finally, if you put in the effort, it's much sexier. Neil deGrasse Tyson will tell you, you know, if you're the real configuration of the universe and the stardust from which we're made, commonly is plenty poetical.
Well, okay. Well, let's talk about real things. Do you save the world again?
Oh yeah! It's a spoiler alert. Sure, we snatch victory from the jaws of imminent defeat.
Uh-huh.
So it's touch and go, but it comes down to the last buzzer. But
really, I was hoping for the dark ending where
I like those dark endings myself. Did you see Melancholia?
Uh-uh.
Another Lars von Trier.
Oh no!
Well, that's Charlotte Gainsbourg is in this movie, and she's my cohort in several scenes. She was wonderful. You know who she is?
Yeah, Serge's daughter.
Yeah, Serge's daughter. And she's in those Lars von Trier movies, Melancholia.
I saw, what was the one I saw?
Nymphomaniac and Antichrist.
Those are still on the list. I saw the one about the family, which was like...
Celebration.
Oh,
you're probably
God.
Talking about. Oh, yeah. Good stuff. He's really interesting. The Idiots, you know, Breaking the Waves. He's really good. But those three movies, and she's wonderful in them.
I got to watch them. I've made a point, I got to watch these, but I haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Well, Melancholia is an end-of-the-world movie, but the world ends. I hope I'm not spoiling anything. And it's Kirsten Dunst's characters who kind of accepts it, who's really smart and finally prescient about our place in the whole universe. And she says, you know, we're just evil. We're just kind of an evil planet. Nobody's going to miss us, in fact. And then the world ends, something like that.
Well, look, it was great talking to you.
I guess we got to wrap it up. You're just a wonderful, wonderful individual.
It was fun. I was very excited. I knew we'd get along. How big is your head?
I'd say 7 1/4.
Oh, yeah?
This hat was made for me. I just have a couple of hats, but I like this. Why? You want to try this on?
No, I'm not a hat guy, but I have a hat that a guy sent me.
Oh.
That one's there, but that one fits me. Oh. But I don't think you could wear the hat that was sent me.
I shouldn't take anything more into my home. I'm a deaccumulator, and so I'm
trying
very
to do
careful.
That.
Yeah.
But I sort of deaccumulate into this space.
Well, I see. Well, this is a beautiful artifact. This is an installation.
Yeah,
this isn't a hoarder's. Right.
Well, I got to keep it dusted. Like that was the weird thing is that I realized that like everything's here, but like I wasn't really dusting, so it started to have a sad museum vibe. You know, like a roadside museum where they don't dust and there's cobwebs. And
I know.
I don't want people walking in going like it's a little grimy. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Like, well, you got to get your lady
Lupe
to do all her dusting in here. Hey, I just read that article about Louis C.K. in New York Magazine. Did you read that?
No.
I thought that was a very inspirational and interesting article.
Oh, yeah?
Right now in New York Magazine.
Brand new.
Yeah, and I know you did that
the
number
Horace
one. But I haven't heard it.
First interview was years ago. Then I just did one that's still up there where we only talked about the creation of Horace and Pete. I'd have to send it to you, the two-parter.
I'd love to. I'm so interested in it.
Well, do I have your contact? I think I do.
I'll give you everything.
Okay.
Lake Bell.
She's the one that made me
of
come
course.
After you.
I'm only remembering now. I didn't remember that, of course.
Yeah.
I love her.
She's like, got to talk to Jeff. And then I texted you, and we kind of went back and forth.
Now it's all coming back to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
My uncle Ben, he went to Alaska. My brother Ben went to Alaska. That's the death of a salesman.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes. He went to Alaska. I should have followed him up there. Why didn't I follow him up there? You would have froze up there. What do you know? What are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We ought to do that play.
Or the two gents.
Two gents is what we should do?
Yeah, this is singing though, right?
That's all singing, but you're a good singer.
I could do it.
Sure you could.
Yeah.
Where's North? I have the compass.
That'd be funny.
Let's do it.
All right. Oh, that was fun, man. He's exactly how you want him to be and exactly who he is. And happy birthday to his kid today. And, you know, obviously you can see Independence Day Resurgence. It's now in theaters. WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get some posters, there's cups and things, and all my tour dates are there. The episodes are there. You can get Howl, the app there, howl.fm, for all the archives. You know, do the thing. And, Yeah, I'm a little nauseous. Am I playing guitar today? What do we got going? What do we have going? This is a Les Paul custom straight into a old Fender Champ with a little bit of reverb.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.